Welcome to the 102nd episode of The Brainstorm. It was a pretty eventful week. Nick, rocking Gen 1 Meta Ray-Bans, the collector over there. We'll start there, and then we'll leave it up for debate as to what to tackle next. But things that are coming to my mind, we had NVIDIA on the inference chip side, interesting, but the NVIDIA Intel, probably worth discussing. What else do we have? We had Grok 4 Fast changing the shape of the AI curve. At least that was the tweet I saw going around. Dive into whatever that means. Nick, Flub demo, good indicator for future progress. People are saying this is them moving fast and breaking things again. Is that the case? What was the announcement? And is that the future?
They certainly broke a few things. So last Wednesday we had Meta Connect. This was their update to the Ray-Ban lineup, the pair I'm wearing. And then they also announced the Meta Ray-Ban display. And I think we'll start there because that's, you know, the real showcase. That was what the event was focused on, because this is the first pair of glasses that Meta, or really I want to say any major tech company, has put out that's both affordable and probably useful and usable if you were to judge based on the demo. But this Meta Ray-Ban display has a 20-degree field of view AR lens in here. So you actually have, for the first time, a pair of AR glasses with a display. It uses waveguide technology, which is you're able to etch into the lens itself. Think of it a frame where the light can sit to actually display the video and picture that you're seeing. I thought that, coupled with a new type of input device, really stole the show. So a few years ago, they acquired a company called Control Labs. Control Labs was working on a wristband that was able to pick up on electrical impulses being sent from your brain down to your hand, basically catching that around the forearm area, and then being able to use that as an input device into the digital world. And so they showed off the band. Looks, I would say, akin to a Whoop band. So there's no face, there's no watch feature. It's just a strap that connects just kind of above where you'd probably wear a watch. And it's, again, picking up on those electrical impulses being sent down to your fingers. So you saw Mark Zuckerberg and a few of the other individuals over on stage kind of, you know, twitching their hands in ways that seem familiar, as in, like, if you wanted to turn up the volume, you'd go like this. If you wanted to type or write something out, you actually could do that on they were doing it on a desk, but in theory I think you could probably do it in air, and then it would translate into the screen that you're seeing it etched into the lens. And so that's a new input device and method that we've never seen before. And I think the real showstopper here is the price tag. You'd probably think this type of technology seems pretty far out, and it's going to cost a boatload of money. And it does, but not as much as you'd think. It's not over $1,000
its price. Not too
much. Yeah, one boatload. $800 to see the future, to play with the future. So I thought, yeah, what they announced, that coupled with, you know, they expanded their Ray-Ban lineup, they added better battery, a host of new features for the second generation of these, and then a few new SKUs of glasses with Oakley as well. So they're definitely going for it. They're pitching this as a glasses first revolution. In the keynote, I'll end on this. In the keynote, they talked about, you know, we want these to be usable. So we went after the 10 most used features of a smartphone. So you have texting, you have video, you have photo, you have all of the things that you're accustomed to using your phone. The majority of the time you pick up your phone, that's what they went after first. And I think that's a really smart product decision to begin with. But I'll leave it there. Yeah. And I think
the price point was surprising. If you go, I think it was 9 months ago, they showed off the prototype of these glasses. And the prototype was bigger, boxier, and had like $10,000 worth of stuff in it, so that they can, even if they're selling at some loss, that they can package it into an attractive, like something you could imagine someone wearing, that it, you know, it comes with the wristband and that it's $800, is a real, meaningful performance per cost inflection. And so my guess on this is that these are going to be underpowered. It's going to be the early adopters that use them. Nick is going to get some, and then they'll be on his shelf collecting dust with all of his other smart glasses. Some people will find them kind of quasi useful, but mostly for the camera. But it's like, if a year from now they have another iteration of these that's better, and the year after another iteration that's better, for roughly the same price point, this could become a meaningful product category that goes from a like, oh, like early adopters have it, to like actually these mainstream use cases begin to emerge, and people begin using kind of like and get used to the user input, which I'm sure there is some learning curve to. And then it could be really competitive in the kind of device landscape.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's, you know, there's initial skepticism anytime you see a device, you know, that is new and it has all of these different features. But I think as you start to build out the vision that, you know, and think about the vision that Zuck has been laying out, it does, you know, once the hardware and tech is actually there for the cost, I think these become a meaningful part of how you interact with the digital world. You know, having that heads up display, it's not fully intrusive. So I mentioned it's, you know, 20 degree field of view, which is actually quite small. The human eye typically has, it's over 180. I think it's actually 210 if you were to think about your peripheral to peripheral. So it's a very small heads up display, and it's meant to not be intrusive. So it's meant for more, think of it as notifications, right? You get a text, it's right there. You're able to respond in real time with your fingers, or you just interact with voice. So not having to pick up your phone for a lot of the use that you might have to. If these glasses can take away some of that, I think it then begins to build the habit with the individual that when then you go to open it up to third-party developers, you let the app store proliferate, that's when you're going to start seeing this become more of a primary compute device versus what I think it will be for the next few years, which is ancillary, niche. It'll pick off different, you know, uses, but not, it won't replace the phone anytime soon.
Well, I think it's easy,
but I think
I was going to say, I think it's like this direction. A lot of people are moving this direction now, right? Like there's like the noise of Rabbit and Humane and all of this. It's like, even with the iPhone Air, people are like, okay, this is the miniaturization. This is leading to something else. You've got OpenAI with Joni, on whatever device they're going to develop here. And so my question is, it's like, okay, I think this future is coming. How important is the wristband here? Or is this a novelty that's going to fade out with some camera that's just pointing down that can interpret your finger? Because, you know, to me that it's like, okay, they bought this, and so this is the path they're going for. But it doesn't necessarily seem like the Occam's razor simplest solution.
I think you're seeing a glimpse into the future. Like, I don't think what they announced last week is ready for prime time use. And I think that's, you know, probably why it's still quite expensive. The wristband, I think, eventually gets to the point where it's also your smartwatch. And so if you have the use, you know, the use case that this is a smartwatch first, but I can also control my heads up display using, you know, gestures, I think that is kind of where it will fit in. I would be surprised. I have to use this first, because everyone that's used it, all of the reviews are, this is game-changing technology. Brett, you mentioned how much tech they're packing into it. Like the heads-up display, we didn't even get into that. But that is like an incredible achievement. The brightness, it's 5,000 nits, which is a score on brightness. If you look at any type of outdoor TV, there are maybe 2,000 to 3,000. So you get any type of
this direct is the sunlight. Sun right in your eye.
Yeah, you yeah, get direct what sunlight. You have nothing, you know, you can't see anything. But 5,000, you'd be able to see through a lot, you know. So you can use this on a pretty sunny day, which I think, again, you're packing a ton of technology, not just to the glasses, but the wristband itself. Mm-hmm. But as you continue to miniaturize that And then you can take that wristband and you can pack it into a smartwatch, and you can continue to make these frames. You know, Zuckerberg talked about it. We've spent, you know, countless hours and days trying to figure out how to shave milligrams off of this device to get it to something where it doesn't weigh down on your face, so it's all day use. And there's really no one else spending this amount of money on this type of technology. I mean, we don't know exactly what Apple's doing. We saw what Google did a decade ago, but we don't have any definitive proof that they're really anywhere close to where Meta is. The only other company that's doing anything in this space in a meaningful way is Snapchat, and that's a disaster. Like, you look at the devices side by side, one looks like someone took the frame of a Cybertruck and pasted it on a pair of frames, and that's what the Snapchat lenses and spectacles look like. And then you have the Meta Ray-Ban displays, which look like, you know, a slightly thicker version of a silhouette and glasses that you're very accustomed to using. And so they've spent $70 billion in Reality Labs over the past 5-6 years, packing it not just into VR, but VR and AR. And VR gives way to AR because a lot of the technology is shared. And I don't know that it's going to be very easy to catch up to what Meta is doing here. Like, I think
is Snap a disaster, though? I mean, like, Snap, yes, I mean, relative to Meta is, but if you think of it as like, well, having AR glasses actually is a really important move in terms of serving the consumer. And then you have a bunch of other hungry companies that want to serve the consumer in the same way. And they're like, oh, we're behind by a couple years to Meta. Why not just snap up Snap in order to, like, you know, advance ourselves a year of those couple years immediately?
It's
kind of pocket change to mega cap
tech. I don't know if that does the trick. I feel like Snap's like a play version that's useful because of its social graph. But it's like, if you need hardware innovation, I don't think acquiring Snap's tech brings you closer.
I also just don't think Snap as a company has the broader ecosystem to be able to initially support the use of their glasses versus Meta. As in, if you look at what Meta announced,
well, that's why the acquirer has to bring like a set of, you know,
but I don't
assets,
I mean,
here.
Again, a lot of it is behind the scenes. We've had them announce, but their glasses are still in beta, so it's only out for developers. I think they cost around $1,500 as a developer if you want to use them. And so you can be able to create, and they're trying to like back their way into or jumpstarting a developer community by giving it out to them. And then once they go and launch, they'll have this third-party ecosystem already deployed on the glasses versus Meta, which is just coming to market with 10 specific use cases. And they're saying, this is only what you can do with these pair of glasses today.
Nick, if you could either, on the one hand, take Apple's AirPods business, or on the other hand, have Meta's smart glasses business, which would you rather have as the kind of like strategic foundation on which you're going to build your AI, you know, castle?
Hot take, but I actually think AirPods, because I believe as interesting as glasses are, I think you ultimately want to be as unobtrusive as you possibly can to the consumer. And so asking every, you know, billions of people to wear glasses all day, every day, that's a bigger lift from a convenience standpoint than asking a billion plus people to wear AirPods with what I think they should do is put a small video camera. In the front, so you're still able to capture video at, kind of at eyesight. That to me seems like a better position to be in longer term, because I don't know how I feel yet about the heads-up display. I think I really need to like play around with these and understand how much of the time I want to be seeing video when I'm walking around.
But right now, like you say, it's basically like the smartwatch face, but just up here, right? It's just notifications, you know, messages. You can see your camera field of view, which might be useful, but it seems like it's very light. But the direction it's going to go is that's going to expand, and you'll be able to do kind of look through stuff. And then, you know, if you want to walk down the street and you want to be like, oh, take all of the, you know, detritus off the sidewalk so I don't have to, you know, have my vision polluted by this stuff, then you can do that. And you can be like, oh, I want everybody I see on the street to seem extraordinarily attractive. I don't want to have to drink alcohol for that to happen. I just want it to happen. You know, like I think there is an expansion factor that you could take by having the glasses up against somebody's eye that is not going to be available if you just occupied the ears. And so that would be
you're taking the meta. Which one were, to answer your question, which one would you take?
Well, one, I mean, relative to the size of the franchise, AirPods is just a bigger franchise already, and everybody's already buying them. And so I think it's hard to give up on that. I would take the Meta glasses plus the Meta management over the Apple AirPods plus the Apple management. If I could take the AirPods and give them to Elon, then I would take that as my bet. But that's not in the cards.
Yeah, maybe a different way of answering the question is you'll need both, right? As in, I think what we're heading towards is the proliferation of wearables, and they're all seamlessly connected. And you have your digital assistant, which is run by one of these large language models, personalized down to you. And when you swap in your AirPods, your digital assistant is there, and it has all of the real-time information that you were just using your glasses for. But you can put your glasses down, pick up your AirPods, and it's the same type of interaction that you're having, just voice native versus maybe heads up display plus voice. And then you're going to have your smartwatch and your smartphone, and they're all going to be interconnected, working together to collect this massive amount of data on you to then personalize this experience such that you're walking around and you feel like Iron Man with Jarvis. And that's where I think we're heading. So you need all of those wearables, I think, at the end of the day, but each one offers you a different entry point to the consumer. And I don't know that one is necessarily better than the other, because ultimately you'll need all of them to really fulfill the need that the consumer is going to want.
I think they're going to overlap faster than you think. It's like the glasses have earphones already. It's like you can't have one. It's like they're not going to isolate on those trajectories. I think from the beginning, it's just going to be a fight for cognition. Attention.
But you'll always
their AirPods are already like cannibalizing the watch. They're going to do like heart rate monitoring through the AirPods now, right? Whereas,
but then I find it hard to believe that one of these is just going to go completely away. I think people will still always have preference. You'll need that, you know, you'll need AirPods for certain situations, as in, you know, you need over the air or over the head earphones for certain, you know, plane rides and such. And so there's different reasons to have different devices. And I think it's not a hard lift to just embed the same type of compute into these devices in 5 to 10 years from now when everything's miniaturized. And, you know, if you can fit into the AirPod, which is the smallest, I guess, device we're talking about, then it can be fit into any other device we're talking about.
All right.
I do think that, like, in terms of early adopters of this stuff, I think people, you know, there's this whole New Yorker article last year on people that are trying to do like janky versions of this just if they're hard of hearing, so they can get actually subtitles in restaurants from other people. Because even like a well-tuned hearing aid just is not enough. It picks up too much background noise. I think for people like that, or imagine people in movies, people at home now, like turning on subtitles on movies all the time. Like if you go to the movie theater, you could wear one of these and get like your own little subtitle thing built in. And, you know, Christopher Nolan always undermixes his dialogue, so you could actually hear everything they say during Oppenheimer. So, you know, I think people will find, you know, kind of like these niche use cases where this is really useful. Or somebody was posting in a birthday, like, it shouldn't be videotaping the person blowing out the candles. You want the person's point of view, seeing everybody celebrate them. Well, these enable that kind of like shot to happen more natively. So I think kind of just the camera and some small stuff with like, call it captioning in the device, will prove useful for some set of people, and we'll see where it goes from there. But
yeah,
I would bet on Meta's velocity and trajectory here relative to Apple, even with their AirPods.
All right, I'm going to switch our topics. We've run out of insightful things to say on this topic for now, other than It's exciting. Meta's clearly moving the fastest in this space. And there are other people going after it in different ways. But
I think we should do another topic, not the ones you mentioned, which is that Coinbase, you can now get
DeFi.
Ostensibly like an 11% yield on kind of your USDC that you hold on Coinbase. And so this is... Coinbase is going directly after the banking function from the perspective of basically like checking savings and kind of yield generation and lending, whereas Robinhood is going after kind of like from the brokerage angle into the social stuff. So, Nick, how do you think about the intersection of those two companies? And like, what does this mean for the banking industry that Coinbase is like, I can get, you know, either 4% yield on just holding USDC in my account, or I can go for like 11% if I'm like shifting into collateralized lending here.
Wait, before I'll buy Nick time. Nick, think. This reminds me of the last cycle though, where it's like yield doesn't come from nowhere. Right? It's like this is always.
This one comes from US Treasuries. This is backed by the
money. No, this is not the 11%.
Oh, this is, you're talking about the 11%. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, I was thinking more of the 4%.
It's like this is classic, you know, like the hunt for yield has started, and that is the start of the risk on hidden leverage cycle. Right?
Yes.
Well, Brett, feel like when I've pushed on this specific topic, when you're talking, but isn't the idea here that you can actually provide transparency into where the yield is coming from? So it is, should in theory be inherently safer than a bank where you really don't know what they're lending out to. You don't know who's controlling the risk management as an individual depositing as a bank. You really have no idea where that is then, you know, being lent out to. Here, you should be able to see like where that 11% is coming from, as in like if they're putting into high yield, I don't know, credit spreads or like
no, it's all collateralized. Yes, you're right. You're right in that if a bank is paying you 11% interest, you're like, because that means they are doing some kind of, you know, lending at very high rates of interest and taking on all kinds of risk. And 11% doesn't come for free.
Coinbase does it. It does come for free because, you know, that's low. That's low relative to the true risk of crypto assets.
Well, here it's all lending against sketchy assets on a collateralized basis, and so you know your loan to value is ostensibly constrained in some way. Where if you know the underlying collateral drops, then you automatically liquidate out into to protect your depositors. And so it's one category of lending they're doing that is over collateralized auto liquidation. And that is different from what traditional banks do just because they can't do the auto liquidation mechanism in the same way. And at a high level, I agree with you, Sam. This is, you know, Coinbase is advertising this. They're advertising, hey, here's a credit card. You can get 4% back on Bitcoin, but then you only get the 4% back if you hold $200,000 in USDC in an account on Coinbase. So these are all of the kind of plays that the, call it the companies that went bankrupt last cycle engaged in, which is kind of like incentivizing stickiness in order to pay out big rewards in order to attract more assets to the platform. The difference is that Coinbase is publicly traded. You can see their balance sheet, like they have audited financials. They presumably have like lots of lawyers looking over this stuff and trying to do it in a safe way. They have like a franchise to build rather than they're trying to make a quick buck. But I think from a, you know, a marginal kind of, there's probably heavy overlap with Coinbase and traditional big banks in the US. And those customers, you know, they're like, well, you know, maybe I should hold more assets over here because they're offering me a better deal than the banks are. So it might be all tiers in the end, but between the end and now, I think it offers like actually a reasonable competitive threat to the traditional banking franchises.
It could. It does almost seem too good to be true.
Well, that's,
I feel like the native yield that is already being you know, realized off of ETH staking and SOL staking is already like, wow, this should satisfy my hunger for yield. But now it's, it looks, you know, it's half of what I think SOL.
Yeah.
Yeah. SOL gives off, which is,
I feel like it's, well, to, Brett, to your point, clearly traditional players, it's like, I think we've been talking about digital wallets for 10 years now, right? And it's like, I think it's starting to happen in a real way. It's like, we've seen sparks of it happen in the past, right? There was like Cash App making great progress, but then really plateaued. You know, there were hints in emerging markets of exciting things happening, but it's like, okay, it's come for the US and in a real sticky way, right? It's like, Robinhood, I think, clearly better on a UI perspective than any other brokerage out there. And yeah, Coinbase, I don't know. In my mind, Coinbase runs parallel. I can see that there's likely future overlap, but it runs parallel to Robinhood in disrupting a different avenue. But yes, it's a, like, compelling to then take whatever you had. If you have savings in Chase or Bank of America or whatever, then I don't get what you're doing, because they're not passing on anything to you. And it's like, you know, maybe it's convenient because you trust the name. And for that, you're willing to let your money be inflated away to nothing. But to me, it does. It's like Robinhood coming for the brokerages, Coinbase much more coming for core banking business now.
Yeah, I think that an interesting thing to require the banks to do, they should have to send out a bill to each of their customers that say how much interest they didn't give to those customers relative to if they were in treasuries. So if you hold like $100,000 or whatever in a checking account that's not paying you 4%, then they have to send you out the bill for, like, you paid whatever, $4,000 for, you know, you have $1,000 a quarter subscription to a bank.
Right.
And actually, if you look across the US, it's kind of like, I think it works to $160 a month or something for checking accounts across the entire US population that people are paying in interest foregone.
So Coinbase one, no brainer.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a compelling product offering, and I think they feel the fact that they have the leeway to go out and try to do this and do it all on their platform. They're not shifting people into a Web3 wallet to do it. They say, hey, we are providing this for you, is a real change in kind of at least their willingness to provide services that are directly competitive with banks in a meaningful and profound way. It's kind of like, you know, why be in like checking account that's paying you zero, and then like maybe you roll into a money market account that's paying you four, when you can be on Coinbase and your effective checking account pays you four, and they're offering you this thing where you're like, oh, I don't know, and it pays you 11. Just seems
peace
like
of mind.
Very compelling.
Yeah, peace of mind.
It's peace of mind. Like that's the tier of why you don't do the 11%. Right. Do you want to have a good night's sleep?
If nothing else, hopefully this, it's like, competition tends to be good for the consumer. Hopefully this forces banks to, you know, actually pay out to the end user some.
Yes. Or maybe it forces them to take more risk and it causes like a systemic blow up in the whole system.
That's
one or the other.
That's competition might be good for the consumer. Okay. So then last thought there. What is your just the takeaway is, okay, traditional banks clearly under threat here, or late stage part of the cycle, 11% is great, but may not last that long. What's your
big well, I think if they attracted capital, it would compress those spreads. So right. it won't be 11% if people do it. And I think kind of your the thing you laid out, I think is right, where it's like digital wallets were occupying categories that traditional banking didn't see as even meaningful categories, as in like peer-to-peer transfers. They were like, you're never going to make money on that. And the idea was, well, you can create like a sticky set of customers that then you can cross into products that are meaningful for banks. Now you have Robinhood on the brokerage side clearly taking share from these legacy financial institutions that have trillions under custody, and Coinbase on the real core banking side, SoFi you could throw in there as well. They're offering kind of real meaningful income generative product competitors to the traditional banking sector. And there's, you know, Robinhood says it all the time, but wealth is transferring from the boomers who are all dying to like this set of people who are more digitally native. And I don't think those people have ever been into a bank branch. Like, what do they care that their wealth manager at JP Morgan has an office? You know, they don't. And also the fact that he's says, no, crypto is not something you should be interested in, they know is wrong. And so it creates this window where kind of like the passing on of wealth can also be a transfer of very, very large buckets of funds into more modern digital wallet companies.
All right. That's a good summation there. Brett, do you want to call it here? 30 minutes, nice for the end user? Or do you want to dive into the AI bucket of topics here?
No, let's save it for next time. Or they can just, you know, have AI synthesize for them what we would have talked about or generate for them.
Yeah,
what
ask
we
Grok about instead. For a fact.
Yeah, ask Grok.
Yeah. All right. There you have it. Wrapping it up in a timely fashion. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore, ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.